Position on 12812, reel 2.
Mr. Hanley, reel 2.
Your legs up against your knees up against the mess table, which was bolted to the deck. Your back against the ship's side and wedged there like a peg. I've heard blokes in that position crying out, "Why can't that hook those bastard get us some fine weather?" You know, but still full of respect for him. And when we did the commander raid on Norway, there was never ever any idea of not doing what was demanded. Here again, Navy discipline, which was all supreme.
You said that some of the officers might not be respected. What did an officer have to do to command respect, or what did he do to forfeit respect?
An attitude. The exercise of discipline in a disciplinary way with an understanding of what he was doing. I think probably an officer who is not quite sure of what he's doing has still got to give the appearance that he knows what he's doing. Never mind what you're doing, so long as you're being followed so that they can appreciate that you're doing. Of course, particularly with chiefs and petty officers, it was very often that they had more knowledge of the situation and what was required than the officer under which they were serving. Now, that officer would be... it would be ridiculous for him not to rest on the expertise of the petty officers and chiefs below him, because at that time, at the turn of the start of the Second World War, a lot of these chiefs had been serving in the First World War and had been called back as reservists. They had the Navy at heart. They had probably been on pension for a year or two and something like that. But they were the British Navy, and it is on their expertise that the success in the early part of the Second World War rested. You had officers who'd been ashore for years. They'd been out in parts of the Empire. It was one of those funny things. An officer could serve ashore for 2 years and be given a ship within a week or two. You see, he had no experience of seagoing for 2 years, but if he had good petty officers and chiefs under him, he needn't worry. They would lead him where they thought he should go. And if he was a good officer, he'd know just how far to go and how much to rely on them. If he didn't, then he made a rod for his own back. And I think a part of as I've just said, and I can't emphasize it too much, discipline is the answer.
Did you ever have any officers who tried to treat the men as equals, and what would the attitude of the men be towards that?
Generally, no. If there was a chink in that disciplinary attitude, it could have been played on. It could have also betrayed to the rating the veracity of the officer. Do you understand what I mean?
Not really.
If an officer was seen to be unduly familiar with any particular rating or even groups of rating, he would have to back that familiarity up with an attitude of authority. If the authority was missing and he was just arseholing in reverse, no, not on. Just not on.
So they'd expect him to exercise authority?
Yes. Yes, that's what they'd been brought up to.
Now, when you first joined the ship, what you said that you were partly with the doctor responsible for the state of health of the men, what kind of complaints were you dealing with, apart from accidents like the one you mentioned?
Well, each rating had a health record, so they would come with the rating or be sent on soon after the rating had joined the ship. So you had your records of the health of every single rating on the ship, not the officers. I don't know whether the medical officer had the officers' records or not. They would have some sort of records, I think, but I was never privy to them. And the only relationship I had with officers as regards medical matters was if they were injured in any way, or if they had a complaint which required my assistance with the doctor. Generally, the ratings with the medical... you might have got a rating who was on long-term treatment, particularly it was venereal disease or something like that. He was capable of duty, but he might have to be have a blood test occasionally or something like that, which required my... my attention. Generally, it was mainly for accidents, bronchitis or whatever. But strangely enough, probably the biggest complaint of all was crabs, scabies, lice. Now, I don't think generally people realise the sea is not a clean environment. The sea smells, and if it isn't washed by fresh, or whoever it is, isn't washed by fresh water, they will stink. Now, you have a ship, it's got a 3 weeks trip from Skapa or Iceland to Murmansk. Nobody can get undressed, you can't bathe. You might, if you're lucky, get a shower, but that's most uncertain because the sea's rough, everybody's combined together, and lice are the most friendly of things, and it's amazing how they find their way from one body to another. And without exception, they do, and no matter how you try to keep clean, you will, whether you like it or not, become infected. I remember once when the whole ship was infected, when the crew had to get all the hammocks, blankets and gear together, left the ship forward over the gangway into HMS, I think it was, that's right, to go through the bug blinder on the depot ship. You went off forward with your gear. Your gear went through the big steam disinfector, the bug blinder, we called it. You were shaved off in the showers and showered and disinfected, went along and waited for your gear to come out, collected your gear and went back on the ship aft. So that the idea was that you came aboard clean aft, you went off dirty front. So that if you'd have done it both ways, there was a chance you would have been reinfected, which invariably you did, you know. Depending on how long you were at sea and the chances for carrying out hygiene. I must say this, there's no cleaner individual than a sailor. He does his own dobying, he showers as much as he can. The circumstances in which a sailor finds himself the victim of any disease or anything is just out of sheer inability to do anything about it.
So that process was to get rid of crab lice, was it?
Yes, lice, and, you know, the little... And scabies was a little bit different. Scabies used to burrow underneath the skin and had to be treated by blue unction. That was where you scratched a lot. The other lice, the only common louse, invariably went on the hairy parts of the body, under the arms and in the pubes, where you had to shave off and be disinfected. But scabies would bury under the skin, which required what we used to call blue unction. What the devil was it?
Permanganate? Potassium
permanganate? No, it was blue unction. In other words, blue ointment. One of these metallic things, you know, which would clear it up. Sometimes, with the diabolical conditions under which these men lived, you would get bronchitis. On a rare occasion, you get pneumonia. an interesting tale here. Later on, in after a year or two I'd been on board, we had a couple of CW candidates. These were officer warranties, officer candidates, going to be officer material and going through Naval College. But I had to do a naval period at sea for sea training, 3 months generally. And one turned up for the ship just as we were about to leave Scapa, I think it was. And we went to sea soon after he joined. He was violently seasick. He was so seasick he had to turn in his hammock. Now, for a seaman or any rating to have to turn in his hammock meant he was really bad, because the petty officer would certainly not allow you to skulk or anything like that, you know.
What does turn in your hammock mean?
Well, turn in means to just go to bed in your hammock. The cots were no good in those days on small ships. A hammock was always the best because it would give every way, you see. And this rating was turned in, and he couldn't eat even in his hammock. A big fellow. And the doctor and I got very worried because we were 2 or 3 weeks on a convoy or something like that. The prospect of getting him off was just couldn't. We couldn't even get him near a bigger ship to transfer him. And he began to die. And we gave him a saline drip to keep him going and got him ashore in Russia and flew him back. That's a true story.
What was wrong with him?
His metabolism wasn't capable of being tossed around like that. Maybe he had a disease of his inner ear or something like that. We don't know. But he was dying. Terrible. Yeah.
Was bronchitis and pneumonia common?
Not very common. I think probably depending on the rating's ability to look after himself. For instance, I used to issue eventually one vitamin C tablet to every member of the crew a day. This was to try and supplement the lack of any green vegetables. All we had was tinned stuff, or bread was out after a day or two. There was no bread. Spuds, if you were at sea a long, long time, spuds would give out. And all you had was... In fact, I think on one occasion I remember having hard tack. That's bully beef and ship's biscuit. Actually, not bad. Because on a ship's biscuit, it's just like a dog biscuit, and probably was a dog biscuit, I don't know. But you could chew on that. It had sufficient sustenance to keep you going. I used to put jam on mine and eat a ship's biscuits, you know.
So the vitamin C tablets were a substitute for the famous lime juice that sailors used to have?
Well, lime juice you only got out in the tropics. You know, I can't remember issuing or having lime juice. I had lime juice when I went out to the Pacific, but not on the northern run, no. The doctor and I deemed that one vitamin C tablet. This was discovered, strange enough, in Nelsonian days for scurvy. In fact, it's amazing to think that before Nelson, when they suffered from scurvy a lot, all they had to do was go ashore and get some of these native vegetables. I never saw any signs of any scurvy or anything like that. But
did you ever have TB on board ships?
No. TB in the Navy was always very much sought after, and chances were eliminated. X-rays were always done at the slightest suspicion. And Navy ratings, when they joined the ship, invariably they were inspected, or you had his medical records, and over his naval service he would have every conceivable test that was available at that time.
Was venereal disease common?
Fairly. But
in the Onslow?
I think if we're getting into an area now, what I would be, prefer not to give any statistics. I would give attitudes to it, but I put it this way: inconsequential. It is of no consequence. So a Navy rating who had venereal disease would not go to sea, though he would go ashore and be treated and depending on whether it was gonorrhea or syphilis, once the visible signs had disappeared, he would then be allowed back to active duty. Where syphilis was concerned in the early years of the last war, a rating was never considered cured.
What was the attitude towards it? A self-inflicted wound?
That's very funny. No, you've got a boatload of sailors who've been at sea, never seen a woman for weeks on end and that sort of thing. They're allowed ashore. Well, it's asking a lot of a sailor. Now, behave yourself and don't run any risks, you see. Well, the Navy recognised that by being able to issue condoms. One of my jobs, when lads were going ashore, they would come to the sick bay and take the issue. I had no qualms about it.
Were they free?
They were free, yes. They used to get them by the gross, you know, always stacked up with condoms. The lads would come on, Doc, give me another one or two, you know. They would, I'll give you sippers or gulpers. You know, gulpers is the tot, you know, and it was used as a minor form of currency. If you did a favour for your oppo, he would give you sippers. So the following day when his tot came, he'd allow you just to have a sip of it. If you'd done a big favour, he'd give you gulpers.
What was that?
Well, a gulper was about two sips or three sips. He'd allow your lips to go proper. If it's quite true, gulpers and sippers, you see. And then if it was a real, he'd give you his tot. And for a sailor to give you his tot, it was like giving you the Holy Grail. I've done a tome on one of these, I'll let you have it, of an incident where the Gog is concerned. An interesting story, and I'll let you have it after this lot.
But
where were we?
You weren't supposed to limit the supply of French letters to them.
Well, you were. You were running really to give the Navy and its wisdom in those days. When I was training, you gave them a French letter as you went ashore. I think probably the powers that be probably underrated the the prowess of the average British Navy. Naval rating, you know. I mean, say, one French letter to a lad who's going a night ashore, you insulted him. It would have insulted me, I think.
But as far as the captain was concerned and the officers, if one of their ratings caught venereal disease, would he be punished?
No. No. It was only punished in this way. I did come across one case where a naval rating had what he was proud to call a nap-and. Because what happened in the British Navy, you had a form called S576. This was a form or a card, a record of his treatment, and a record of how he had acquired that venereal disease. It was his name, his rating, rank, ship, and what have you, all that information. And then, strange enough, how and where he had acquired it. And strange enough, whether it was a professional or an amateur.
Meaning?
Yes. Now, that seems strange in one way, but it isn't. Because in the early days of the last war, and in peacetime, I think, if a rating had acquired venereal disease from a prostitute, the police had powers, I believe, to go to that prostitute and insist that she receive treatment. Don't forget this. If you had the fleet in, you'd probably have 10,000 men ashore. The pubs and brothels of naval bases are legendary. A pub, a brothel in the old days used to be the norm. Well, there was always venereal disease in the British Navy. That's how the Hawaiians caught it. That's how some of the Pacific Islands were almost decimated by the onset of syphilis. And these are things that the British Navy had to be alive to.
But you were talking about this nap hand.
Yeah, I'm talking to you. The onset of a venereal disease in the Navy could have decimated the fleet. So every step had to be taken to control it, at least, if not eliminate it. See, that's why they had these cards. Well, I had one rating who had five cards, called a nap hand. Five cards at a game of cards is a nap hand, you see. nap hand, you see. If you've got nap hand, it means you've got a flush or something like that. And on his last card, he had this rating as being informed that any reoccurrence of this disease will jeopardise his future in the Navy. In other words, if he had allowed himself to become victim of his excesses, the Navy would then be prepared to get rid of him, because he was a risk to the Navy, and himself in particular, you see, taking up time for the Navy, running danger of being sick and somebody having to take his place on a ship. It's akin almost to the abolition of the tot in the modern British Navy, and the British Navy now being dry to a certain extent. Where you've got button pushers these days, you can't have him under the influence of drink, can you? In fact, I'm still surprised that the officers are still wet in the British Navy. I don't know whether they are with atomic submarines or not, but if you have any individual that's under the influence of drinking in charge of anything of a modern type of thing, it's dangerous.
Now, can we go back to the Onslow, and can you tell me about the duties that the ship was carrying out when you joined her in the autumn of 1941?
Captain D of the 17th Destroyer Flotilla. That meant there were usually eight destroyers of the same class, generally, with the same first letter, Onslow, Oraby, Onslaught, all O, the O class. Then the P class was another set of names beginning with P. And Captain D was the foreign captain of the flotilla. All the other skippers would invariably be commanders or lieutenant commanders. The flotilla leader would also carry the fleet, the flotilla officers, who, when there were problems on other ships in the flotilla, they would come to the commander, the engineer commander, or the gunnery officer who was stationed on board the flotilla leader. That was the captain's staff. There was also the, Marchant was the lieutenant commander. He was really the chief officer underneath the captain, you see. In a destroyer flotilla, the captain of the ship was also the Captain D of the destroyer flotilla.
And where was Onslow patrolling and so on?
Onslow sailed from the Clyde straight to Kaskapa to call what was working up. She'd been accepted by the Navy from the builders after doing the measured mile off Paddy's Milestone. That was the Ailsa Craig. And that mile is still there. It is a nautical mile, now I presume radar controlled, where ships under trial can work up to full speed and have their engines assessed. I remember being on deck when Onslow did trials over the measured mile, and there was a spirit in that ship which was wonderful. We're all new to the ship, brand new ship. You could smell the paint peeling kind of thing, oil, hot oil, and all the bearings hot and that, but the ship was under full power, and over 40 knots. A magnificent sight for a 2,000-ton ship. I can see the bow wave now, as high as the ship itself, where we'd worked up to, and everybody, the adrenaline, that was the first, I think, the first real experience the ship had itself of the spirit which eventually stood it in good stead. I know it was an awful existence, generally, But you were in a... It was your home, whether you liked it or not. And if it was a good ship, it was generally a good home. So we were strangely enough. I don't know why you say being proud of a ship. It could be the most bloody awful experience you ever had, and you'd be proud of it.
So you said it went to Scapa Flow.
Went to Scapa Flow to work up gunnery exercises, torpedo exercises, depth charge exercises, and interspersed with this training, you get escort duty out into the Atlantic, bringing back an aircraft carrier on the last stages of a journey into the Clyde and things like that. You were working whilst you were working up. A ship has to work up. The crew has got to learn how to work together. The captain has got to know the worth of his officers under him and that sort of thing. It takes time to mould a ship together. But in this particular instance, worked very well.
How long was the working up period?
Well, we never considered ourselves working up. We considered ourselves as being, in the fleet, ready for anything, which we were, because within 3 months, we were doing a commando raid on Norway, the Vagso raid.
You've already mentioned those POWs aboard and that incident with the captain. Can you take me through the Vagso raid as you personally remember it, step by step in detail?
Yes. Leave Scapa under orders, and in a small ship, you have what's called the buzz. You even have it on liners today. If a liner does something different than what the passengers expect, buzz goes round, and before you know it, you're going somewhere you haven't been before or something, but that's a buzz. But on a small ship, you get atmospheres, not so much buzzes. It pervades from the captain down a look, a change of routine, and something's coming off, you know. Nobody knows, only the captain, and maybe his privileged officers, those who are concerned. So in this particular case, we sail from Scapa, and we turn north. Now, you're certainly not going down to the mainland if you're going north. You're either going to Russia, Iceland, or somewhere like that. As it turned out, we were going to the Shetland Islands, Lerwick, I think, and we knew something was up. Then, as we tied up in Lerwick, we had some army officers come aboard, and two intelligence officers, magnificent fellows. God, it was right out of Boyzone, you know. These scruffy-looking individuals, I suppose they were Navy intelligence. I think they had some sort of Navy uniform, and they hadn't shaved for weeks. And they were rough, and also they carried cudgels, one particularly. I think it was the knob end of a big tree trunk. Is about 2.5 feet long, and what he'd done is hammered 6-inch nails, 50 of them, into this ball of the trunk and took the heads off. Now, can you imagine any finer weapon than a darn big heavy cudgel with about 50 sheared off 6-inch nails? One blow on that, the man would have disappeared like a bomb, you know. One blow on a door, the door would be gone, and that's exactly what was... These two intelligence officers came aboard, and we then knew that something really was happening. And the captain, as we weren't going ashore and it was sealed, security-wise, he then told us we were doing a commando raid on Norway on Boxing Day.
Tube, you pump the water right out into the sea.
Yes, I see.
If you just drain the tube, it wouldn't bring.